homeownership has long been associated with things like raising children, having a place to grow old, and a place to provide for the ones you love. It's one piece of the American dream. It also has a history of being an important part of financial stability and security. With so many things changing, from the types of jobs available to the prices and locations of homes on the market, the path to homeownership is less clear than before. But does that matter? Nancy Kwok is an associate professor in the History Department and the Urban Planning and Studies Department at the University of California, San Diego. She researches the history of cities, urban planning, and housing policy, and is the author of the book A World of Homeowners, American Power and the Politics of Housing Aid. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on, Judith. It's a pleasure.
Well, we think of owning a home, I think, as kind of this innate desire that's always been part of our lives and our culture, but it really hasn't. There was a time when home ownership wasn't such an expected step in the idea of successful American living. So where did this idea come from?
Yeah, you're so right to acknowledge the sort of short history of this American dream, and it's most certainly a fairly new dream. Really, even up until the 1920s, Americans didn't think about owning their homes en masse. And it's really connected to this larger history of changes in the system of credit, this idea of buying a house on credit. So to sort of denaturalize what we now think of as home ownership, I would say, you know, when we get a mortgage and we buy a house, we call ourselves proud new homeowners. And we don't say, hey, congratulate me, I just assumed a massive amount of debt to be paid over 30 years. So there's a real cultural shift that needs acknowledging here. And it's really driven in the 1920s by mortgage lenders and home builders who are really actively promoting this idea of buying a house on credit. But it's really not until the federal government gets involved in the 1930s that the majority of Americans begin to participate. And the federal government's getting involved, of course, because of the Great Depression and because it's trying to save banks, not because it necessarily wants to save individual households.
And also during and right after World War II, the government was also pushing out lots of affordable housing. When and why did we see a shift from providing affordable housing to providing mortgage assistance, perhaps for less affordable housing?
Yeah, no, that's another good question. And I would start by clarifying that what happens after World War II with the Veterans Administration, with the GI Bill and the sort of mass promotion of homeownership is not ever a sort of golden age of homeownership. It is a very particular kind of homeownership that the federal government is setting up. So if you look at the overall statistics, it's true that from 1940 to 1950, you go from 43% to 55%. So we become a majority homeowning society. But this does not play out in any way if you look at it broken down by race. So first, I'd start by saying that there was never a moment where affordable housing was the priority sort of in this equal way. It was a very particular kind of vision of who would become homeowners and who would benefit from this sort of federal policy. And of course, the more recent story is one where that racial dynamic continues and is really highlighted. But certainly, as you see homeownership sort of accelerating, and we're now in the 60s in terms of percentage of people who are participating, it differs greatly depending on which generation and which race, you're seeing a lot more compression of the housing stock that's available in key locations. And so now we're talking a lot more about this sort of affordability crisis as opposed to just sort of accessing homeownership broadly.
We're talking with Nancy Kwok right now. She's an associate professor of history and urban planning and studies at the University of California, San Diego. And we're talking about how the idea and the dream of home ownership has changed over the years. And I know, having grown up in primarily in the 70s and 80s, there was always this thought that buying a home was a really good way to invest. And it was a very safe investment. And it was a way to not only put a roof over your head, but also to be putting money away. And this is something that has really changed for newer generations, younger generations, because they saw what happened in 2008. How has that idea of homeownership changed?
Yeah, no, it's very true that millennials simply don't buy into the same rhetoric and the same sort of ideology that Gen Xers or that boomers buy into, in this case, literally. So we have I believe the latest figures show about 32% of millennials owning homes, and this is significantly less than the same sort of percentage rates for Gen Xers or boomers at the same age. So we're not even talking about comparing 70-year-olds with, you know, 25-year-olds. We're talking about the same 25-year-olds when they were at that age. So it's true that millennials are owning less. But if you actually also dig into the data of surveys of what millennials are saying, I don't know that it's strictly ideology. The number one reason that millennials state for not owning homes is that they believe they cannot afford that mortgage payment. They cannot afford the down payment. And so really what we're talking about is whether or not the housing stock is actually within the price range of people who want to own them. And then, of course, the question becomes which housing? Because there always is housing available in this country that people can afford, but it might be in the wrong state or you know, just out of reach physically from the jobs that millennials are aspiring to or that they hold. And so there are all kinds of reasons why people are choosing not to own homes that don't necessarily have to do only with not believing in the sort of values attached to home ownership.
Paul on Facebook wrote, with the student debt that many millennials carry, owning a home is out of reach, or they can move into a shack, but most are not willing to live in rundown areas. So he's touching on something there. First of all, the debt that many millennials have that really make a mortgage seem completely unrealistic. But also, there's a difference between owning a home in a city or a suburb or owning a home in the rural area. And what do those different literal landscapes look like for homeowners?
Right. Absolutely. The compression in the housing market is happening only in some cities, first of all, and then even in those cities in some neighborhoods. So it is very much about location and about commute time. How long are people willing to spend on the road? How much energy and time do they have to do that, given that many people are actually not working 40-hour weeks? They're working much more than that. And so there's all kinds of reasons why people choose not to participate. And I really like your comment about the sort of quality of the house as well and the quality of the lifestyle. For millennials who are, you know, getting married later and having delaying childbirth or perhaps not having children, there is little incentive to, for instance, to pay attention to the schools in a neighborhood. They might pay more attention to where the amenities that they use, you know, are located. So absolutely, location is critical.
Another comment on Facebook, this time from Ruth, was, we are much more mobile in our jobs and living. Many find renting easier. And that's an interesting, I think, cultural shift, too. There was a time where you started your working life, whether that was after college or maybe right out of high school. And the expectation was that you might stay with that company for your whole career or possibly work for maybe two. But now there is an expectation that you are going to have several employers and possibly even different careers in life. And that seems like it would be a huge change in how people look at owning a home.
It's absolutely. Home ownership is very rigid, obviously. So you can't change or expand your house depending on how many people you're accommodating in that house at any given moment. And you certainly can't pick up and move, you know, as easily as you can as a renter. So it certainly limits your job opportunities if you're thinking just, you know, what can I afford to do with this house that I now own? And I believe it's, you know, the advice that's typically given is if you don't believe you're going to stay at least 5 years, it makes little financial sense to absorb all the sort of initial costs of home ownership when, in fact, you want to remain highly mobile. So I think that's a very savvy sort of understanding of how you choose where to live.
We're talking with Nancy Kwok right now. She's an associate professor in the History Department and the Urban Planning and Studies Department at the University of California, San Diego. We're talking about where the longstanding desire to own a home came from and whether or not that's an attainable dream to have right now. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're not a homeowner, do you have a desire to own a home? Has anything made that goal hard to reach? And if you do own a home, has it added value to your life or maybe even your bank account? Did you feel pressure to buy? And if so, from where? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about home ownership, everything from why we want to own homes in the first place to what the housing market is like today. Our guest is Nancy Kwok, an associate professor in the History Department and the Urban Planning and Studies Department at the University of California, San Diego. She researches the history of cities, urban planning, and housing policy. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. If you're not a homeowner, do you want to be? Is anything preventing you from making that a reality? Or if you'd prefer not to own a home, why? If you are a homeowner, what's the biggest challenge? And what do you like about owning your own home? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones. And Wade in Madison is up. Hi, Wade.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask about the consequence of those choices. You know, it sounds like there are many reasons why today some of the younger folks in America are choosing not to own homes. But as a longtime homeowner and also somebody who's invested in real estate and rents it out, it seems like a much stronger position to be in to own that over time. And the consequences of those decisions might come home to roost in 10, 20, 30 years when one continues to have to write checks and end up with a drawer full of receipts instead of actually owning something.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Wade. And what do you think, Nancy? Is there still a good benefit in investing in your own home or maybe even in real estate in general?
No, I think this is a real problem that Wade has put his finger on, which is that this unequal access to homeownership, if you will, is exacerbating inequality. We all know that there are financial benefits of homeownership. Of course, it's a way of encouraging or forcing savings, really, across 30 years. But there are also immediate rewards like the mortgage income deduction, which, by the way, is one of the single largest and really invisible federal subsidies for homeowners. And not just the deduction, but the idea of building equity, which is really important for later leveraging higher education. All of these remain out of reach. And even statistically, if you look at what renters are doing, they are statistically more cost burdened. Cost burdening, for those of your listeners who might not be familiar, means that you're spending more than 30% of your income on housing. So if it means that 52% of all renters across the nation are rent burdened, then what we're talking about are people who not only are not reaping those long-term benefits, but who are from the get-go spending too much on housing. So there are all kinds of ways in which this is not an ideal system.
Thanks for that call, Wade. Let's go now to Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I thank you for addressing the racial issue. Would you mind describing in a little bit more detail the mechanisms by which racial minorities are discriminated in obtaining housing?
Thanks for that, Tom. And certainly historically, there's been redlining, but there are a lot of other factors, right, Nancy?
Right. So there are. This is a very long question, actually, and a really a deep one. So I'll start by saying that the federal role in this racial inequality is profound. And you just mentioned redlining, and you're absolutely right to do so. In 1933, there's this organization called the Homeowners Loan Corporation, created by the federal government, which sets up a process of determining risk based on four different levels. And of course, probably many of you have seen these color-coded maps. Now, it's important to note that Hulk is not creating redlining, actually, although a lot of people attribute or misattribute the federal government's role in this particular case. The federal government is simply building on what the private industry is doing. But in any case, this system of risk rating is institutionalized by Hulk and then carried forward by the FHA, which is created the following year in 1934. And of course, a lot of these sorts of processes of determining where people will lend and where people will not lend are not just directed towards African Americans, although most profoundly and most painfully, usually in cities, towards African American families, but also to, and I'll use the terms of the time, towards Mexican families, Orientals and various ethnic minorities in various categories, depending on which decade. So all of this process comes to a head by the time the Fair Housing Act is passed in 1968. But of course, when you have these sorts of Fair Housing Acts, and there are subsequent legislation to try to neutralize the process in terms of race and these sort of categories of difference. But of course, the process is always enforcement. And we see by the statistics that, in fact, racial segregation has actually increased, not decreased, despite these efforts.
We are talking right now with Nancy Kwok. We are talking about homeownership, how it's been part of the American dream for many, not attainable by all, and what it looks like now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones, and Heather in Madison is up. Hi, Heather.
Hi. My husband and I, we did buy a dwelling, but we didn't buy a single family home. We decided we were going to buy rental property. So we bought a duplex, we live in one side and rent out the other. And we did that on purpose because we could get, a mortgage deduction like your expert's been talking about, but we also had additional tax benefits. So we kind of thought about it. We had to, in rental property, you have a different kind of down payment system than you have in a single family home. So we had to save a lot longer to do that. And we've been able to get some financial security from that. But now we're looking at buying a single family home. And I think that the prices, at least in Madison, are very cost prohibitive. And it is a big commitment, even for us who've been, in the market, so to speak, for a while.
Thanks for that call, Heather. And Nancy, that's certainly an issue when the housing stock becomes so expensive, even people who own might have a problem selling and being able to buy anything else.
It's true. And this is how the middle class is really squeezed. And what I mean by that is that if you are able to participate in the housing market and that housing market is hot and it continues to rise in value, then you're doing very well. You're really making a lot of profit, whether instantly or when you sell. You're building equity. You're profiting in all kinds of ways from a hot housing market. But if the middle class is increasingly being squeezed out, not to mention, of course, the working class, what you're seeing happening is that the number of people who are profiting is growing steadily smaller. And this is a real problem. Like, you can't have a housing system that benefits so few people. So absolutely.
And let's go back to the phones. And Bonnie in Oconomowoc is up. Bonnie, hi.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment that we had a home in Waukesha that was just extremely clean, newly painted, pretty much updated. We allowed for a $6,000 carpet allowance so people could purchase their own carpet and replace carpet if they felt it needed to be replaced. Plus, we had brand new white appliances and they wanted stainless steel. And we found that the millennials want to move in to a home, a used home, that is almost like a new home with all this type of appliances they want, with the carpeting, everything painted. They want to be able to just move in, move their things, and not have to do any work.
And that's an interesting point that Bonnie brings up, Nancy. Is there, I think there used to be a phrase that we used a lot, that there was your starter home and then there was your dream home. Has that changed a little bit with later generations as well?
That's a really funny story. Not in the sense that it's humorous, but rather that I think what's happening, and I'm just guessing, I don't know these specific people, is that people in the millennial generation are perhaps less willing to invest in the sort of home improvements because there's less of a sense of home ownership or actually owning some part of that housing or that dwelling being part of their obligation to a property. And I think that's part and parcel with a system that doesn't allow certain people to participate in home ownership or that doesn't allow them to participate in ways that they want to. So your story doesn't surprise me terribly in the sense that people who don't see a particular unit as their responsibility are not necessarily going to want to fix it up, not necessarily going to want to put their money into fixing it up either.
Thanks for that call, Bonnie. And Nancy, as we move forward into a new decade, do you have any predictions or ideas about what homeownership might continue to evolve into in the future?
I would say that there are a couple of things I would say. First is this actually in the midst of this horrible housing affordability crisis, there is a little bit of ray of hope in that we've seen historically what policy can do, and that federal policy actually makes an enormous impact and difference on the way housing is distributed and who has access to it. And of course, it hasn't been always for good, but in this case, we could take the lesson that there is the ability to make change through this mechanism. The other ray of hope, in my opinion, is that millennials are prioritizing values that put at the center the environment. They want places that are walkable. They want places that are smaller in their footprint. And these are all values that we could all do well to espouse.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a very interesting conversation.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was Nancy Kwok. She's an associate professor in the History Department and the Urban Planning and Studies Department at the University of California, San Diego. She researches the history of cities, urban planning, and housing policy, and is the author of the book, A World of Homeowners, American Power and the Politics of Housing Aid. We talked with her today about the history of homeownership. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, with a push to move some large federal agencies out of the Washington, D.C. area, we'll look at how that might work well if it's done correctly. A human trafficking story out of Kenosha has made national news. We'll find out what led to a teenaged victim killing her alleged trafficker and what might be in store for her. On Food Friday, Deb Perlman of Smitten Kitchen joins us to talk about the year in cooking, hers and yours. All that coming up tomorrow on Central Time.